Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you novelist Isabel Allende this time. It's a talk from Portland Arts and Lectures in 1989. Allende was born in 1942 in Lima, Peru, to Chilean parents. The niece of Salvador Allende, the former president of Chile, she started her writing career as a journalist. Several months after her uncle's assassination and the overthrow of Chile's coalition government in 1973, Allende left Chile and found refuge in Venezuela. She eventually relocated to the United States, where she now lives. Her first novel, The House of the Spirits, published in 1985, arose directly out of her exile and became a worldwide bestseller and critical success. In 2000, her novel, Daughter of Fortune, was chosen for the Oprah Book Club and went on to be an international bestseller. In all, she has written 20 books that have been translated into 35 languages that have sold over 65 million copies. Among her numerous awards, she was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2014. Join me for Isabel Allende here on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
Thank you. Oh my God, this place is full. I'm always paralyzed with fear the first minutes, but I get over it. I'm sorry, but before I begin, I have a message. I was in a conference, in a lecture in Seattle, and a person approached me, a man with a beard, and he said that there would be a woman called Mary here in the audience, and I should read this. Is there a woman called Mary here? The message says, your story was always a love story. So, Mary, you better answer. Okay. Tonight, I would like to talk about the meaning of writing, a theme that has been in my mind for a short while, let's say 20 or 30 years. The opportunity to prepare this conversation with you has been very important to me. It has forced me to organize my confused emotions and to put in words those concepts that have been with me for a long time and that I use automatically, but never until now had the need to articulate. However, I'm afraid that my long training as a woman and as a mother has repressed in me all capacity for generalization. So please forgive me if I express myself with particular examples. In England, Salman Rushdie published a sarcastic novel. In Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini ordered his followers to kill him for blasphemy. And now, fanatic Muslims all over the world are sharpening their knives. What is it that the Ayatollah fears so much? What can the book destroy or corrupt? How powerful is the written word? Why was Galileo forced by the Pope to deny his discoveries about the solar system? Why have so many authors been in prison, tortured, and killed throughout the history of civilization? It's very hard for us to understand. We think that we belong to a different culture where these things would never happen. In 1989, in the Western industrialized nations, literature is only an artistic or an intellectual achievement. It doesn't even deserve to be censored. However, the fear of the written word is not unknown to us. Only 50 years ago, the Germans woke up one morning with Nazis burning books in the streets. The same thing happened in the most refined and tolerant country of the world, Italy, not to mention Greece and Spain. And here, in the United States, in the 50s and part of the 60s, writers and journalists were persecuted for their ideas. And still now, in many cities, books are banned from public libraries. So maybe we should give a closer look to this matter. Maybe there is something magic in words, after all. I'm not trying to justify Khomeini, please. I think that his fanaticism has thrown Iran back to the Dark Ages. The West has a debt to the Muslim world, because while we were stuck in the shadows of the Middle Ages, they kept burning the torch of knowledge inherited from the Greeks and the Romans. Now the pendulum seems to have gone the other way. No, I'm not justifying Khomeini. I'm only wondering about the importance and the power of literature. Catherine McNamara, a writer who has been working for many years with Indian texts in Alaska, told me that those people are very careful with words because they think that words can produce good or evil. I found the same belief among primitive tribes in the Amazon. Among the Saname Yanomami, for example, you cannot call a person by his or her name because you would be touching the soul, and that would be very dangerous. For them, the word is the thought. The word is the intention. The word can be life or death. Words have the power to create and to destroy. This is a terrifying feeling for a writer, but it is also a fascinating one. I grew up in the house of my grandparents. I was brought up to be a lady. It didn't work that way, actually. You can imagine how disappointed my family is. The house was an old, large, and somber place, inhabited by weird people and by benevolent spirits that my grandmother summoned with her three-legged table. I belong to a crazy family, which is very fortunate, because with such relatives, I don't need to stretch my imagination. They alone fulfill all the prerequisites of magic realism. I had an uncle who looked like Rudolph Valentino. I see no reactions. You don't know who Rudolph Valentino is? My God, my age is showing. You know who Carlos Gardel is, at least? Well, like that, Spanish-looking, dark eyes, grease in his black hair. He was handsome. He loved books. He bought them by hundreds and cherished them like holy relics. He always wore a coat, a long black coat with big pockets, to hide the books that he stole in public libraries, bookstores, and the homes of his friends. His room was a tunnel of books, and at the center a small bed and a lamp. One day, during an earthquake — Chile is a land of cataclysms, not only political, also geological — we heard a terrible noise, as if a train had crushed my uncle's room. We tried to open the door, but it was stuck. The shelves had fallen on the bed, and my uncle was buried under a mountain of books. In despair, we started to remove the books, looking for his cadaver. Finally, we found a foot, and we could drag him out. He was in perfect health and in control of all his faculties, including his sense of humor. That was my first contact with literature, and since then, it has not lost its excitement. The house of my grandparents was invaded by books. Books were everywhere, like a magnificent flora amidst which I wandered with my mind and my senses agitated by indiscriminate readings. No one ever censored or guided what I read. When I was 7 or 8 years old, I took to school a volume called Philosophy of the Boudoir. The nuns were very impressed with the word philosophy, and they had never heard of the author. So they didn't suspect that I was a pioneer of pornography. The author, as you know, was the Marquis de Sade. My uncle gave me the love of books. He told me that at night, the characters left the pages and roamed in the house. Warriors, courtesans, princes and criminals strolled from room to room, impregnating the air with adventure. 30 years later, when I became a writer, his idea was confirmed. My house is full of presences escaped from literature. My stepson, Scott, says that since I came to live with him, He can hear spirits haunting the house. My husband says that there are raccoons in the roof. Lawyers are always manipulating the truth. I can no longer distinguish reality from fantasy. The limit is a blurred line. Everyday life is full of fantastic events, and in turn, literature seems to be saturated with reality. Everything is possible. Eva Luna, the main character of my third novel, says that she writes as she would like the world to be, and that she lives her life as a novel. I feel that way too. As a reader, I allow myself to be carried away by the enchantment of a narrative. And as a writer, I surrender myself to the pleasure of telling a story, convinced that it is, if it is not true at this moment, tomorrow it will certainly be. I believe that some writers are only instruments. They interpret the voices that are in the air. Why is it that at the same time three well-known Latin American authors published novels about dictators, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Raúl Roa Bastos, and Alejo Carpentier, published simultaneously the same year books about the same theme? At that time, half the population of Latin America was living under a military dictatorship. These writers interpreted the collective terror. When I write, I deal with forces that I cannot control, like my grandmother did when she talked with her ghosts. Strange things happen to me all the time, things that I cannot explain. Later, if you want, I can give you some examples. It is true that I write because for me it's unavoidable. It's a matter of survival. If I don't write, I die. Writing is always a private orgy. The possibility of creating and recreating the world according to my own rules. Fulfilling in those pages all my dreams and exorcising some of my demons. But that is not the only reason for writing. There must be something else. The idea that there is magic power in the written word can be a very heavy responsibility. So I have been asking myself, why do I write? What is the meaning of writing? And in order to explain what is the meaning of writing, I have to start by asking myself, what is the meaning of life to me? Ultimately, I am what I write. Therefore, I must define myself as a human being in order to discover why I write. Writing is a very solitary pursuit. In the last few years, I have spent most of my time alone. And in the daily exercise of trying to interpret reality, not only its visible dimension, but mainly its hidden forces, I have learned something about the passions and the ideas that move people. In my writing, I try to understand the world, to make it more tolerable, and if possible, to change it. I'm not modest, as you must have noted. To create stories, I have to observe, to listen, and to ask questions. Sometimes people ask me which of my three books I like the most. I don't know. I have never read them after they were published. I have forgotten all the details and most of the important parts too. Each story is so demanding that I have to erase from my memory and from the computer all the previous ones. I don't remember the books, but some characters have never left me. They still live in my house, like Clara del Valle, Irene Beltrán, Professor Leal, and Barabbas, the dog in the house of the spirits. Most of my characters are not invented. I use real people, people that I interview, or that I have known, or that belong to my family. They don't talk to me anymore. Very few of my characters are product of only of my imagination. One of them is Riyad Halabi, the Arab in Eva Luna. I have never known anybody like him. At a certain point, when I was in the middle of the book, I had this little girl lost in the street, hungry and miserable, she really needed a savior. She was trapped in a dead end, and I was wondering how I could have been so stupid to put us both in such a situation when all of a sudden Riyad Halabi appeared in my study. He just stepped out of the shadows, and he must have been there for a long time because he knew everything about Deva Luna. And in a very casual way, took upon himself the responsibility to rescue her. Riyad Halabi didn't look like a phantom of my imagination. He was a heavy man with Mediterranean features, dressed in a brown suit. He had his own voice, his own smell, his own way of moving around and expressing all of his emotions with his eyes that were black and wet like olives. He also had a hare lip. And I said, gosh, why a hare lip? I have to eliminate that. But of course I couldn't, because a rider is just a rider, not God. Riyad Halabi became one of my favorite friends. And although the book does not belong to me anymore, he remains near. He has a loving and generous nature, and he has taught me many things. During the process of preparing this lecture, I discussed some ideas with him. He would visit me sometimes in dreams or would appear in my study, looking like a robust ghost. And we would talk. For him, the main reason to exist is to help others, because in giving and sharing, he finds joy. I have also talked about this with some good friends, special people. A couple of weeks ago, I found myself sitting at the table in the home of our best friends in Berkeley. In Berkeley, anything is possible. It was meant to be a dinner party, and it became a Chekhov play. There we were, a group of friends, discussing the meaning of writing and the experience of life, or the meaning of life and the experience of writing. Outside it was raining, and the room was illuminated with candles. Chekhov would have been delighted. My poor husband has had to deal with a theme every night for a year, with great damage to our sex life, I must admit. For months I went around asking everybody. Some were not very enlightening, like that policeman that pulled me over when I asked his opinion about the meaning of writing. He replied that silly questions couldn't save me from getting a ticket. But others were very helpful, like my 11-year-old stepson, who said that we are here to save the planet and more about everything, so books should be about that. He reads comics, Garfield, Hopes, and some other things about Japanese green monsters that crush San Francisco. My friend, the writer Tom Farber, said that his mission is to create truth and to give a piece of his truth with the only tool that he has, language. He believes that he is on earth to celebrate life. My mother thinks that life is an opportunity for the spirit to learn and to grow, and we have to improve ourselves in order to improve humankind, so writing should be at the service of this cause, or else it's a waste of time. She is the most severe critic of my books, always demanding depth and truth and beauty. 7 years have passed since my first novel was published, and in this time many things have changed for me. I'm constantly confronted, not only by my wonderful mother, but also by other readers. It is not enough to write in trance, overwhelmed by the desire to tell a story. One has to be responsible for each word, each idea. The published word cannot be erased. Maybe that is one of the main reasons to write. Write to prevent the erosion of time so that memories will not be blown away by the wind. Write to register history and name each thing. Write what should not be forgotten. But then, why write novels? Well, probably because I come from Latin America, a land of crazy, illuminated people, of catastrophes, a land so large and profound, so beautiful and frightening, that only novels can describe its fascinating complexity. A novel is like a window open to an infinite landscape. In a novel, you can give illusory order to chaos, find the key to the labyrinth of history, explore the past to be able to understand the present and imagine the future. We can use everything, testimony, chronicle, essay, legends, poetry, and other devices that might contribute to decode the mysteries and search for our identity. For a writer who nourishes him or herself of images and passions, to be born in my fabulous continent is a privilege. European and North American critics often stare in disbelief at some of our books, asking how the authors dare to invent those incredible lies about young women who fly to heaven wrapped in linen sheets, of black emperors who build fortresses with cement and the blood of emasculated bulls, of outlaws who die of hunger in the Amazon with a bag full of emeralds on their back, of ancient tyrants who order their mothers to be flogged naked in front of the troops, and of modern tyrants who order children to be tortured in front of their parents, of hurricanes and earthquakes that turn the world upside down, of revolutions made with machetes, with bullets, poems, and kisses, of hallucinating landscapes where reason is lost. It is difficult to explain to these scholars that these things are not products of our pathological fantasy. They are written in our history. We can find them in newspapers every day. We hear them in the streets. We suffer them frequently in our own lives. I come from a land of great contrasts where people have to survive in great violence, two excellent ingredients for literature, although for the citizens of that reality, life is often suspended from a very fragile thread. Hyperbole, extrasensory perception, the overwhelming presence of nature, legends, myths, traditions, the force of destiny, extreme passions and obsessions are some of the ingredients of Latin American novels. But they are not only literary devices, they are part of our own lives. For 25 years or more, the writers of the ill-named boom of Latin American literature have been narrating our continent, our reality, and our collective dreams to the world. In doing so, they have often defied the totalitarian regimes of their countries, and most of them have been forced to live in exile. We also have our little Ayatollahs in Latin America. Very few North American writers realize that in most part of the world, authors have to face repression, all forms of repression, all over Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Eastern Europe. Writing is a dangerous job. It's only here that writers live in a bubble. I loved my grandfather. He was a handsome old man. He looked like a painting by El Greco, with sharp Spanish features, a mane of white hair, and a heavy silver cane on his knees. He was the model for Esteban Trueba in the House of the Spirit, the patriarch. We never agreed on anything, but we really loved each other. My first novel began as a letter for him. In 1981, he was dying. He was already nearly 100 years old, and he decided that he was tired of this nonsense and it was time to die. So he sat in his chair and refused to drink and eat until death was kind enough to call him. And at that time, I was living in exile in Caracas, and I couldn't go back to Chile to bid him farewell. I wanted to tell him that he could go in peace because people only die when you forget them. And I wanted to prove that I had forgotten nothing. I had all his memories with me, and I would keep him alive in my heart and in the heart of my children and my future grandchildren. So, to prove him that, I began writing the first anecdote that he told me when I was a child, the story of his first fiancée, Aunt Rosa, who died poisoned by mistake. He died before I finished my book, or the letter at that time, but I went on writing and writing, and after a year I had 500 pages, and that spiritual letter had become something very similar to a novel. It was The House of the Spirits. Well, I know later the story drifted in other directions and other characters stepped in and I couldn't stop them. So it was no longer the story of my grandfather or his life. I think I tried to put there everything. I stole other stories and I tried also to talk about my country. My grandfather was a pragmatic Basque, fascinated with science, technology, and the English language. He thought that those were the foundations of progress. He accepted only that which seemed logical or could be demonstrated, and he dismissed as irrelevant and improbable emotions, instinct, intuition. He was a typical representative of our Western culture, which has strategically ignored that which escaped the boundaries of reason. He was extremely skeptical about my grandmother's experiments until she suggested that maybe it was not the souls of the dead that moved her three-legged table, but extraterrestrials. Now that was scientific. And her husband became much more tolerant with the autonomous jerks of the furniture. My grandfather wanted the world to be like a Swiss clock, stable and secure. This has been an obsession to man for centuries and had its climax in the 17th century when Newton created a consistent vision of the universe as an invariable and perfect machine. My grandfather was not up to date because the dream of the magnificent clock had been destroyed several years before his birth. The discoveries in the fields of physics and astronomy forced man at the end of the 19th century to look for a new metaphor that could explain the universe, a universe in constant movement and expansion, a metaphor that could describe an elusive reality. This idea horrified the old man. My grandmother, on the contrary, had an ironic disrespect for materialistic progress. She thought that science and technology were very useful to improve standards of life, but inappropriate to achieve wisdom. In this respect, she trusted more inspiration than reason. My clairvoyant grandmother is Clara del Valle in The House of the Spirits. I didn't have to invent anything. She's just like that. She died 37 years ago, but she's still with me. She's always with me. And maybe some of you can see her here, standing here. She's dressed in white with her false teeth hanging from a chain at her neck. She was an extravagant and charming lady who assumed that there are many roads to knowledge. She even believed that Spanish is also a decent language, although she wanted all humanity to speak Esperanto. In her middle age, she became a protector of artists because she was convinced that a brush, a pen, or a musical instrument were as useful to humankind as a microscope. She was determined to use her senses, her imagination, her experience, and the quiet voices that spoke inside her to expand her perception of reality. She said often that life is a dream of the soul or a thought in God's mind. She died long ago, but we are still in close contact, so I have also been able to discuss my doubts with her. She believes that the mind is fragile and the space of a single life is very brief, passing quickly, so quickly that we never have a chance to see the relationship between events or gauge the consequences of our acts. Therefore, it is important to write in order to keep alive the memory and to acquire some wisdom. The myth of the universe as a magnificent machine has been destroyed. Now we know how little we know, and therefore we know more than before. This opens the imagination to fabulous possibilities, but it also creates a feeling of deep uncertainty. My generation with few exceptional moments of illusion and hallucination in the 60s, has stumbled through life with a feeling that every day we lose something vital, we destroy something irrecoverable, and we take another step toward a nuclear cataclysm. The message seems to be, why worry about the future if maybe tonight someone will absentmindedly push the button and we shall never wake from our dreams? Let's have immediate gratification, no matter what the consequences are, because there is no tomorrow. Our kids are offered a cynical view of a society where they will have no common project, only individual goals, where to compete is more important than to share. Free enterprise is more important than free men, and money is a deity. Where being called a liberal, a humanist, or a virgin are insults. Where commitment and generosity are considered naive. Where kindness is sentimental and sentiments are phony. And where love is old-fashioned. Have you noticed how people no longer fall madly in love? They get into a relationship and they get out of a relationship. What's that? In spite of all the modern resources, most people are not happier, which is very good because that forces us to revise our premises. We find ourselves at the turn of another millennium, and as it happened before when humanity reached the year 1000 of our era, we believe, for quite different reasons but with the same fanaticism, that the end of the world is near. We imagine that the four horsemen of the apocalypse will soon be stampeding over our caskets. If there is no hope, we can cover our heads with ashes and mourn at the inevitable, or we can spend the last moments in meaningless pleasures and consumerism. Well, I'm proud to say that I don't belong to the club of desperate intellectuals. I don't think that the end of the world is near. I'm convinced that just as we can destroy the world, we can save it and improve it. I don't feel paralyzed by the knowledge of my own insignificance. Each one of us, and all of us together, are responsible for the statu quo, and therefore we are responsible for the future. We have created this society. We have made the world as it is. We, and only we, can make it different. Never before has humanity had so many resources, so many effective ways of communication, so much information. We are not going back, we are progressing. Half the world has been able to agree on many basic issues: slavery, child labor, colonization, women's liberation. We have also agreed on human rights. Yes, they are constantly violated, but that is done in the shadows because no country is willing to admit that its people are being tortured or are starving. In the same way, I'm convinced that we can all agree, for example, on abolishing militarism. Someday in the near future, we have to establish peace because the alternative is total destruction. Once we achieve that, we will look back at the past with astonishment, just as we look today upon slavery, asking ourselves, how is it possible that for centuries humankind built weapons, fought wars, and nourished the arrogance of a caste whose only mission was death and destruction? And maybe we can also agree on eliminating borders, nationalities, classes. Why not? More people feel now that the boundaries of race, creed, nationality, or class are illusions. That we all belong to the same extended family. We have the same origin. We are all sons and daughters of an ebony Eve, born thousands of years ago in the heart of Africa. There is nothing to be afraid of. We can share. We can help each other. There are many more similarities that bring us together than differences that separate us. Of course, we still have to go a long way in this respect. The fact that more people have this awareness doesn't mean that most people have it. Many things have changed lately. Human beings are changing too. In spite of the fact that we haven't developed not even 10% of our intellectual capacity, we live longer, we are taller. I don't include myself among the taller ones, of course. In industrialized countries, the babies of the new generation are born with the ability to manipulate computers and to imagine the infinite. We have the resources to eliminate hunger, poverty, and sickness for all humankind. We have probably acquired more knowledge about ourselves, the planet, and the universe in the last 80 years than in all the previous centuries. We are conscious of our power of destruction, yet we seem to ignore our capacity to improve our own existence. All dreams about the future can be fulfilled, not only the Holocaust that would reduce us all to sidereal cinders, but also the possibility of paradise on earth, as some poets have proposed. We have come a long way since the first ape stood in its feet and observe the stars above with amazement. We have a fabulous journey ahead of us. In my late teens, I discovered science fiction and became an addict. I dream that the Martians land in my garden and invite me for a tour of the Milky Way. I must be the only woman in the world who has sexual fantasies with E.T. It would be wonderful to come back in 1,000 years, which is nothing in terms of cosmic time, when our minds will be traveling in the galaxies to meet the angels, while our bodies transformed in perfect compact bundles, which will never suffer hunger, pain, fatigue, or deterioration, will have no other task than to explore the multiple possibilities of the senses and keep the breath of human life on Earth. There is no reason for despair. Why is it then that instead of being full of energy and hope, so many of us have this feeling of futility? Something is wrong. It seems that when we headed blindly in the direction of materialistic progress, we neglected something important, and the result is that the spirit suffers. When I write, all these doubts and these anxieties are in my heart, and they appear in my writing, disguised in different forms. As Tom Farber says, the mission is to give some truth. But how? How can we recognize truth? How can we understand the meaning of life? I don't know how a telephone works. How could I understand the astonishing complexity of the creation, with its millions of galaxies and billions and trillions of stars and innumerable dimensions and unthinkable forms of life? Have you ever had a human brain in your hand? I suppose not. It looks like a pound of compact calamari. It is very pretentious to imagine that everything that the universe contains could be understood by this calamari. But it is good to know that humankind has always delved into the mysteries, that all along our history, some men and women have asked the fundamental questions, and that in our genetic memory, the impulse of curiosity is recorded. Joseph Campbell suggested that instead of asking what is the meaning of life, we should wonder about the experience of being alive. Maybe there is no real meaning to life. It simply happens. And our mission on Earth is not achieving anything, only being. Be like the flowers or the wind. Nothing that we do is really important. Our compulsion for tasks or goals, for power or success, for pleasure or wealth, are just ways of escaping from our own only responsibility, which is just to exist as harmonious beings. This idea is very tempting, but being is not enough, because human life is also action. We have to do things all the time, make decisions, choose alternatives. These decisions can be good or bad. I use the terms good or bad in a practical sense. Good is what is convenient for most of us and benefits the planet, and bad is what produces damage. To act, we need a set of values. I think I realized this for the first time during the military coup in Chile in September 11, 1973. That day, my country changed. The set of values which we had been using seemed totally distorted. Even language lost its meaning, and words like democracy, equality, freedom, or compañero were forbidden. We were surrounded by violence. A time of intolerance and darkness began. For the first time, I saw that there was evil in the world and we had to deal with it. But at the same time, I learned that the world is full of goodness and love. While some people were torturing, killing, or denouncing, thousands were risking their lives to help others, to feed the hungry, to bury the dead, to hide the persecuted, to search for the disappeared ones. There is more goodness than there is evil, but goodness is silent and discreet, while evil is noisy. That is why we hear much more about the bad that is done, and we seldom realize how much more good there is. Sometimes evil seems to take over and human beings act crazy, destroying and killing, until ultimately their deeds turn against them and they sink in the swamp of their own mistakes. But most of the time, most of us behave decently if our set of values guides us in that direction. So, if life is not only being but is also action, we need some basic rules to help us. The world is changing fast. We need to revise our concepts of society and to create some principles on which we should all agree, just as we have agreed on other issues before. This is a fascinating challenge. The time has come for prophets, for artists, for intellectuals, for visionary politicians and ideologists, for scientists, and for all the people with the gift of imagination and intuition. Their mission is to dream the future. I would like to be part of that team. I don't know the meaning of my life, apart from love, which seems to be the ultimate reason of my existence, but I'm beginning to discover the purpose of writing. If it is true that the written word has some power, writers can contribute to change the rules. As I said at the beginning, I'm not modest. I have the ambition to improve the world and to use my writing in the achievement of this goal. Maybe I can contribute to create a more gentle way of living. You, me, every one of us together, we can make a real revolution of the spirit. We should all join efforts in the beautiful task of inventing a more benevolent world where love for each other and love for this planet and its creatures will prevail. Once, Gabriel García Márquez said that he writes so that his friends will love him more. I write so that people will love each other more. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, now that the boring part is over, maybe we can have a conversation. If there are questions from the audience, not obscene questions though, I would gladly try to answer them. Can you put the light in the audience, please, I can't see much. You will have to yell, I'm afraid. Okay. Yes. I suppose you didn't hear up there, no? She says that I talk with optimism and with a sense of hope, and where does it come from? Well, maybe out of pain. I have had a very adventurous life, and I have had many experiences, many wonderful experiences, and many very painful. And I've been always in contact with violence and with love. And I've realized that there is much more love than violence in the world, and that's why we're all sitting here, and we're not in the Stone Age. We have achieved lots of things. And I have been in contact with people that have suffered very much. People whose relatives have disappeared, people who have been tortured, people who have been living in exile for many years, poor people, people from the slums, people that have suffered all sorts of repression. And I find this, that they're always full of hope, no spirit of revenge. And I cannot afford to be pessimistic, because they are not.
The Peruvian writer Vargas Llosa is a candidate for presidency of his country. Can you imagine yourself as a writer participating in that way in politics?
No, definitely not. I've never belonged to any political party. I'm a total anarchist. And I can't even belong to a tennis club, to anything. And imagine, no, God's sake. But there is another Isabel Allende, my cousin, who should be president of Chile someday.
You've piqued my curiosity earlier in your talk. You said you might share some examples of the strange things that happened to you. I'd like to hear some.
Let me think of one. Well, the most recent thing that just happened. I went to Chile in December recently for the first time in 14 years, and it was the most moving experience. Well, when I wrote my second novel, Of Love and Shadows, that novel is based on a real crime, a political crime that happened in Chile. 15 people were massacred in 1973, peasants, most of them, and their bodies were hidden in a mine, and they remained there for 5 years until they were discovered. And for the first time, the murderers, the militants, were brought to trial and found guilty. Of course, they were set free, but they went to trial. And I read the story in Venezuela, and I made all the research from Venezuela because I couldn't go back to Chile at that time. And I wrote this book out of anger and hatred. And then, in the process of writing, many things changed in my soul, and I got over all that hatred. Not the anger, but the hatred. And the only person who reads my books is my mother, before they are published, I mean. Afterwards, sometimes other people do also. But before that, it's only my mother. And so she read the original, the manuscript of this book. And I had invented that a priest in confession receives the knows that these bodies are in the mine. And so he goes to the cardinal and tells him the story. And to prove that that he's not wrong, he goes first to the mine, digs in the mine, discovers the bodies, takes a skull, wraps it in his sweater, and goes back to the cardinal with the skull and puts it on the cardinal's desk. My mother said, "You must be kidding. It's impossible that anybody in normal situation would do such a thing. But in a country with repression, in a city under siege as Santiago is, it would be impossible for anybody to travel 50 kilometers with a skull. It's impossible." And I said, "Well, mother, but this is literature. Let's leave it." And we had a terrible discussion that lasted for a week, and finally I left it in the book. My mother never approved of that. She always thought it was exaggerated. Now, when I went to Chile in December, a person insisted that he wanted to talk with me. We were very cautious with the people that we received at home because of the police and all that. But he insisted so much that finally he came. And he said he needed to talk with me because he had been a priest until 1979,
when he fell in love and he stopped being a priest. But until then, he had been a priest, and he was the person who received in confession the news that the bodies were in the mine. And he went to the mine, and he took a skull, and he brought it to the cardinal, and he put it on his desk. And he wanted to know how I knew. And I couldn't explain it because I think I dreamt it, I don't know. And that this is only one example, but often I face these things. So I'm very scared of what I write, very. If you're afraid of walking to the microphone, I can understand that fear. Just raise your hand.
Yo admiro a ustedes y sus libros, especialmente La Casa de los Espíritus y Eva Luna. Pero yo quiero saber si usted está escribiendo un otro libro.
She wants to know if I'm writing another book.
Sí.
Well, my life has changed a lot recently. I met a man in a restaurant in San Jose. There is a restaurant in San Jose, actually. And I fell madly in love. I didn't get into a relationship. I just fell madly in love. And so it was very funny because this man had been a bachelor for too long, maybe the last heterosexual bachelor in California. And so, somebody raised a hand over there. There are two then. And so, I liked him. Well, the truth is that I had been in chastity for too long. So, I just liked him very much. And he invited me for dinner. And I said, I'm too long. I'm talking too much. Well, okay. And so he invited me for dinner, and he said, after a while, in a very cautious manner, that he liked me a little bit. And I said, "What is this? You like me or you love me?" And he said, he stepped back, horrified, and he said, "Well, what are you talking about?" And I said, "Look, I'm 46. I don't have time to waste. If you want sex, I'm not interested. I'm too afraid of faith and that stuff. But if you want a serious commitment, then we can talk." He had never heard the word commitment before, so I had to explain what commitment was. And after that he said, "Well, how can we have any sort of commitment if you live in Caracas and I live here?" And I thought, well, that's a problem, and I moved over. So I came to his house, and I never left. And he had to marry me because he's so polite that he couldn't say anything and do anything else. Well, that meant for me a big change because I'm used to write novels, and novels require space and time and silence and many months of being alone. And now I have a hyperactive stepson, a mess in the house. I don't have a housekeeper. I have a husband. You know a housekeeper would do? If anybody knows a housekeeper, please raise their hand. And so there I am, working and moving to this country and trying to talk in English and all that. And I couldn't write a novel, so I decided that I would try short stories because, not because it's easier, it's much more difficult, but it requires less periods of time. And so in the little time that I have when my stepson is in school and my husband is in the office and I finish with the vacuum and the wash dishing, I write short stories. And I'm going to publish a collection of short stories.
Yo quiero estar una escritora y vivo con mi cabeza en las nubes muy alta. Gracias.
Gracias. Yes, excuse me, but here somebody had risen the hand before. Yeah. Maybe you didn't hear up there. He's talking about that I stress the physical violence. And he talks about the economic repression. There is a very close relationship. In order, I come from a part of the world, and most of the world is like this, where very few people have much wealth, and the great majority has nothing. In order to preserve that situation, these very few privileged groups need to exert a lot of repression among the great majority to keep the things that way. In the international aspect, it's the same thing. The wealthy countries exert a lot of repression among the poor nations to keep the world as it is. The problem is that the gap between the poor and the rich is bigger every day, and the poor people are growing and growing and growing. And there are no borders, no China walls that will ever be able to isolate you enough or protect you enough. We all share the same planet. We are all living in this rock lost in the cosmos. And finally, what happens to anybody happens to everybody. So there are no bubbles, no ivory towers. We will have to learn a new way of living. And that this works for the world, and it also works in a country or in a society. I've seen this in Chile, how a handful of people own everything, the land, the industry, the banks. They make the laws, they do everything, and they use their armed forces as their mercenaries to keep those privileges. How long can that situation be? Not for long. I don't think that we can go on like this for much longer. And more people have conscious of this.
One of the major issues facing the gay community today is what they call the sickness of oppression, the feelings that are evoked, you know, day after day from living with that. That's a hard concept for most middle-class white Americans to conceive of. Could you possibly address the issue of what it feels like, what the feelings evoked are, living under the kind of oppression that you've experienced?
I'm sorry, but I didn't get very well the question.
Okay, what I'm asking is whether you could address the feelings that are evoked from day after day of living under what we'll call oppression, and how that has affected your work and your person.
Well, there are many forms of oppression. First of all, I belong to a generation where women in Chile and in most part of the world are repressed because they're women. That's the first. Being born a woman is a handicap most of the time. That's why I wanted to be a man. Didn't work that way, unfortunately. Then I tried to be a bimbo, and it didn't work either. to live in repression, for me, is unbearable, and I couldn't stand it for long. I lived in Chile for a year and a half after the military coup, and I got sick, morally and physically sick. I couldn't do anything. I was paralyzed with fear. And so I left. But living in Venezuela, living in exile, and facing so many difficulties and this sense of constant failure helped me a lot. I don't think that it was bad in any sense. It was painful, but it was not bad. And it brought out strength that I had and I didn't know I had. And that has happened also in Chile. The people have lived in repression for 15 years, and there are wonderful things happening there, a new strength, new courage, things that we didn't know that we had in the society. So out of these emergencies, these moments of crisis, the best and the worst comes to the light. And there's a lot of good things that happen.
Excuse me. I have two questions. I hope to use one of your books in a class I'm teaching for a community education project here in Portland called the Red Rose School. And I was just wondering if you could tell me which one to use, the House of Spirits or of Love and Shadows. And secondly, recently I stumbled across the fiction of Maria Luisa Bombal, and I was just wondering if you could tell me some other Chilenas or other women writers of Latin America that have passed away unheard of. So that I could add that to my list.
Well, don't use my books. Use Eduardo Galeano's. They're much better. And they can teach about...
Okay. Or women.
Oh my God. There are many good writers in Latin America. Women have been writing in Latin America since Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And yet they are not very well known because they have not been translated, very badly reviewed. They are not taught in the universities. Their books are very badly distributed. There has been a strategical silence for the work of women in my continent. I can give you several names. Elena Poniatowska in Mexico. Luisa Valenzuela. There is a great writer in Uruguay now. I forgot the name. Clarice Lispector, she just died in Brazil. Claribel Alegría. Many, many names. Oh my God, what's the name of the Uruguayan author? Huh? Well, Marta Traba is not a fiction writer, but she's a great writer too. And, I will remember in a minute. Mm. Yes.
Hi. What are your views about Planned Parenthood? In Latin America, there is a lot of population growth, and the Catholic Church is not interested in slowing that population growth. Do you have any particular views regarding that and Planned Parenthood?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not an expert because...
Or let's say birth control, possibly.
Yeah. Chile, in that sense, is very advanced because you can buy the pills everywhere and without prescription and all that. But it's true that in Latin America, the growth of the population is a real problem. But this is something very difficult to deal with because for many people, for peasants, for Indians, children are blessings of God. And to have children is important, even if they cannot feed them. So our concept of having only the children that we can support in an easy way doesn't exist for them. So I think that this is a problem of moral consciousness for each family, and we cannot decide for them. There are many, especially North Americans, scientists and people of goodwill, I'm sure, that have gone to Latin America trying to impose different forms of birth control, thinking that that would help the society and maybe take people out of poverty. First of all, we need big reforms, social and economic reforms. Those are needed before. That's the most important thing. And the birth control is important, but it is not the main thing. And finally, you cannot impose it. I don't know if that answers your question.
I wondered if in the House of Spirits whether you are in it and whether your mother's in it and which characters you are.
I'm not in any of my books. I use part of my biography for Alba, the narrator in the House of the Spirits. She was brought up in the house of her grandparents. Esteban Trueba was like my grandfather. Clara was like my grandmother. The crazy uncles, the fakir, naked, eating carrots, all that was part of my family, but I'm not the character. And in my second book, Irene Beltran, the journalist, works in a women's magazine. She lives the military coup and all what happens afterwards. And that is also part of my biography, but I'm not her. And in my third book, Eva Luna, she doesn't have anything of my biography or anything at all, but all my emotions, she has them. I wanted to talk about being a woman and about being a storyteller. And that's what the book is about.
I really enjoyed your short story, The Mayor's Wife. And I have two questions. First question is, where can we find more of your short stories in print, if there are any? And secondly, it seems in that story that the bandit, I forget his name, the outlaw, fate ruled his life. Now, tonight when you talked, it seems like you feel that we have free will to change things. Why did you have fate get him murdered.
Well, first, I don't have any short stories published yet. I'm collecting them for the book. That was published, I don't know where, I think in a magazine or somewhere. Where? Well, I don't know. It was published somewhere in English. And about fate, I don't know what to think. I think that we can change many things, but I also believe in luck and fate. And I believe that the spirit of my grandmother protects me. And I believe that I was lucky because I found Willie and many other things like that. So I think there is a part of it is fate. And some people are lucky and some are not. And that's the way it works. Now, you can improve your own fate a little bit. A little bit, not much. Well, if there are no more questions, we say goodbye then. Thanks.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was Isabel Allende. She spoke at Portland Arts and Lectures in 1989. Thanks for joining us for the Archive Project. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. And we have lots of other talks on our website, and you can listen to them all at literary-arts.org. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting, produced by Spencer Raymond. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.